Well, thank you very much, Secretary General. Thank you for those remarks. Again, my name is Kurt Volker. I'm the Executive Director of the McCain Institute for International Leadership, which is a part of Arizona State University, and a very proud alumnus of the Elliott School, even from before it was called the Elliott School, longer ago than I care to state publicly. But it has been a great privilege to have gone here and then had a career built upon that. Secretary General, I'm going to open up the question and answer with you, and then we're going to turn to the audience here to ask questions. We'll bunch them a few at a time. I do want to give priority to students here at the Elliott School. So students, think about what you want to ask and get your hands up early. But Secretary General, I want to start with the first question for you. We have heard from President Trump and this administration both during the course of the presidential campaign and since then, many, many things. NATO's obsolete, NATO's not obsolete, NATO allies need to pay their share. We will decide whether we defend them based on whether they've paid their dues or not. When Chancellor Merkel was here, there was talk about how much Germany owes the United States. NATO needs to reform. It needs to deal with counterterrorism. We want to work together with Russia. Russia is a threat. Russia has intervened in our election, so just about everything you can imagine. You could chart this and say, okay, there's been a progression over time. There's been a movement, and you've had a lot of interaction with the president. I know you've been on the phone with him. You had a meeting here today or yesterday in Washington. You've met with Secretary Mattis in the defense minister's meeting. You've met with Secretary Tillerson in the NATO foreign minister's meeting. I know you met Vice President Pence at the Munich Security Conference as well. So I want you, if in your own words, where do you see the U.S. administration on NATO today? How would you characterize U.S. policy, U.S. support, U.S. interests, U.S. concerns?
The message to me and to NATO has been very consistent all the time in all my interactions, in all my different conversations with the president, but also with his security team, the vice president, the Secretary Tillerson, McMaster, and his whole team. And the message has been all the time that they are strongly committed to NATO, that they see the value of that bond, and that they want to make sure that NATO continues to adapt. And I welcome that. Both the strong commitment to NATO, which was reiterated yesterday in the meeting in the White House, which also then expressed, that was also something that the president expressed to me just a few days after he was elected last fall when he spoke on the phone. I welcome the message about commitment to NATO, but also welcome the message about that NATO has to adapt. So when, for instance, President Trump and Secretary Mattis, Secretary Tillerson underlines the importance of NATO have to do more to fight against terrorism, yes, I welcome that. So we are now looking into what more can we do. And when they stress the importance of fair burden sharing, again, I welcome that, because we need fair burden sharing in NATO. We need that more NATO allies invest more in defense. We have to remember that some allies already spend 2% of GDP on defense, the United States, of course, but United Kingdom. You have a country like Estonia, which is present here today. They have met the 2% target. And this year, Romania declared that they will meet the 2% target in 2017. And Lithuania and Latvia declared that they will meet the 2% target next year. So NATO is adapting. NATO is changing, but I welcome the strong focus from the U.S. administration on the need to continue adaptation.
Very good. And do you believe that allies are responding to this call to spend more on defense?
Just need a bit of microphone.
In case you didn't hear, the answer was absolutely they're going to 2% and beyond.
Okay. Is that better? Okay.
Again, Secretary General, one of the you've articulated a clear sense of U.S. support for NATO, but part of the question from the U.S. is, are allies willing to support NATO? Do you see them doing that?
Yes, we have turned the corner, because what we have seen is that after many years of decline, cuts in defense spending across Europe and Canada, we actually saw that in 2016, we saw for the first time a significant increase in defense spending across Europe and Canada. And we have we saw an increase of 3.8% in real terms, or $10 billion, and that is a significant also increased also amount of money for defense. We still have a long way to go, and much remains. But at least the Europeans have started to move in the right direction. And as I said, some allies already meet the 2% guideline. Other allies have declared that they will meet it this year or next year. So what I discussed with the president yesterday was how can we make sure that we keep up the momentum, that we are able to continue to see this positive development. Because what we promised in Wales in 2014, when we made what we in NATO called the Defence Investment Pledge, was to stop the cuts, gradual increase, and then move towards spending 2% within a decade. And we have started to do that. And my top priority as Secretary General has been to focus on defense spending because it is so important for the strength of the whole alliance. Let me add one more thing, and that is that what we call the Defense Investment Pledge is not only about spending. It is also not, it's about spending more, but also spending better. To be more efficient, to work closer together. And it's about the capabilities we need in NATO, and it's about contributions to NATO operations and missions. So very often we speak about that the pledge is about cash, capabilities, and contributions, and all of that is important at the same time.
In your remarks, you said that NATO wants to deal with Russia from a position of strength and to have deterrence and defense, but also to have dialogue and outreach toward Russia and to try to work together with Russia. Does Russia want to work together with NATO?
Yes and no. In a way that we see some areas where they are willing to work together with us, other areas we see that is much more difficult to establish any kind of understanding or real dialogue. But we have to continue to work for dialogue because the world is safer when Russia and NATO are able to speak, to talk, and to strengthen or to improve our relationship. And it's hard to predict how the relationship between NATO and Russia will be in the future. But I just am absolutely certain that we have to do whatever we can to diffuse the tensions and to avoid a new Cold War. And that's why we pursue this dual-track approach to Russia, deterrence, defense, and dialogue. And this is also something which is very much based on my own experience as a Norwegian politician, because Norway, as you all know, is bordering Russia up in the north. We have a land border, and we have a border in the sea, in the continental shelf, where there's a lot of oil and gas and fisheries and so on. And we, and Norway was able to develop a pragmatic working relationship with the Soviet Union during the Cold War and later on with Russia on issues like energy, like border, as we agreed on the border in the sea, the delimitation line, environment, fishery, but also military issues. We have some search and rescue exercises together and so on. There's regular contact between the Norwegian armed forces and the Sixth Fleet or the Russian armed forces up in the north. This cooperation in the north between Norway, a NATO ally, and Russia takes place not despite NATO, Norway's membership in NATO, but because of NATO's, Norway's membership in NATO. Because our membership in NATO provides the strength, the platform, to engage with Russia. So I strongly believe that we should not be afraid of talking to Russians. They are there to stay. They are our biggest neighbor. And it will help all of us if we're able to improve the relationship with Russia.
And final question for me, and then we're going to pull from the audience and students in particular. Did you and the president discuss Ukraine? And how does Ukraine fit in that scenario of West-Russia relations and giving Ukraine a feeling of security so it can deal with Russia?
We discussed Ukraine, and of course we are concerned about the situation in especially eastern Ukraine and the fact that Russia illegally annexed a part of Ukraine, Crimea. And that is the first time since the end of the Second World War that one country annexed a part of another country in Europe by force. So this is, of course, serious for Ukraine, but is also undermining the whole idea of a rules-based order in Europe, which has been so important for the peace and stability in Europe. So NATO, the United States, NATO allies provide support to Ukraine. We help them to modernize their defense structures, their armed forces, their defense institutions, train them. We have different trust funds for cyber, for command and control. So NATO and NATO allies provide political and practical support to Ukraine. At the same time, I think it's important to understand that this is not only about Ukraine, because NATO has the main reason why we have implemented this strong reinforcement to our collective defense, tripling the size of the NATO response force, deploying forces in the eastern part of the lines, is because of Ukraine. So actually, the illegal annexation of Crimea and the support of Russia to the separatists in eastern Ukraine, the continued destabilization of eastern Ukraine, is the main reason why NATO has strengthened its collective defense in Europe, making sure that no NATO ally experiences anything like what Ukraine has experienced with Russia since 2014.
So that's very important for the NATO allies. Mm. For Ukraine itself?
Of course, it is important for Ukraine itself that we provide support, that we help them with modernizing their armed forces, fighting corruption, helping them in command, control, cyber, many other areas where we work with Ukraine. And some allies also provide training of Ukrainian forces. But the way to solve the problem and the crisis in Ukraine is through negotiations, through a political solution. And the best base, and the only basis for that is the Minsk agreements. And we are calling on Russia to use all its influence on the separatists in eastern Ukraine to make sure that they fully respect the Minsk agreements, meaning respect the ceasefire, which is not respected now, withdraw all heavy weapons from the contact line, and allow the international observers to do their work to observe the implementation of the ceasefire, because that's a precondition for any effective implementation of the Minsk agreements.
Great. Thank you. All right, students. I see in the third row here in the center, if we can take this one here.
Given the current Eurosceptic and anti-globalist governments in Poland and Hungary, the election in France, as well as German President Steinmeier's comments on NATO as warmongering, do you think that there are any internal threats to NATO within its members?
So internal threats from within members. We're going to take a couple. There's another one in the center aisle, to your left. Yeah.
Since the end of the Cold War, what do you believe has been NATO's biggest mistake in its interactions with Russia, and what do you believe has been NATO's biggest success in its interactions with Russia?
And we'll stay on the center aisle for now, in the very back, in the blue sweatshirt.
First of all, thank you for coming to speak here. I had a question in regards to how NATO is going to respond in Syria. You spoke about successful interventions in the Balkans as well as preventing conflict in Afghanistan. But keeping in mind the 2011 NATO bombing of Libya, how do you propose to respond to Syrian use of chemical weapons in the United States missile strike 2 days later?
Terrific questions. You can see why the students from this school go places. Okay. Over to you.
Well, they're actually more difficult than I get the questions I get from the journalists. So this is no. First, on internal threats or challenges, I think it's extremely important to remember that NATO is an alliance of 28 democracies. And in democracies, there are different political parties, different political views, open discussions. Some are in favor of NATO, others are against NATO. And in my own country, many, at least some parties and some politicians have been against NATO the whole time. Actually, to be honest with you, when I was young, I was also against NATO. So but the reason why I say it is that we should not be afraid of open debate. We should not be afraid of people having different opinions, even criticizing us. They're always wrong, but I think that's part of living in democratic societies. So yes, there are political parties, organizations in NATO countries which are critical either towards NATO as an institution, or at least critical towards part of what we do. And to be honest, I'm not afraid of that, because I think that NATO has proven again and again that it is a strength that we have open debate, different views, and that we are developing our thinking by confronting different views and then improving, what to say, our understanding of many different and difficult issues and tasks. And NATO has proven again and again that despite differences, despite the fact that we elect some conservatives or some liberals or some social democrats or Christian democrats, people coming from many different political, Republicans or Democrats, whatever it is, coming from different parties with different views, they have always been able to agree on NATO's core task, and that is that we are safer together than alone, and that as long as we stand together and protect each other, we prevent conflict. And the best way to prevent conflict is to send a very clear message to any potential adversary that we are so strong, so it's no chance if you try to attack one ally, because the whole alliance will be there. And again, coming from a small country like Norway, the strength we feel being a neighbor to Russia by having the whole alliance in also supporting us is the reason why also Europeans feel as safe as they do. So my answer is that we should not be afraid of the fact that there are different political tendencies in European countries, because that's part of a natural development, a debate process in democratic societies. The next question
Russia.
Was... Yeah.
Russia, greatest mistakes and greatest benefits.
Yeah, because first of all, I'm not that kind of person that, you know, have a list on my... where I remember my greatest mistakes. I forget them already. I've forgotten them. But I think it's... I'm not able to, in a way, to point at one thing which was NATO's greatest mistake. And again, it's partly linked to the first question, because we are a alliance of 28 democracies. So sometimes it takes too long time to make decisions. Sometimes I would like a clearer, faster implementation. But that very often reflects the fact that in a democratic institution of 28 democracies, it's not always the perfect solutions, but they're very sustainable, they're very strong, because they're anchored in 28 nations. I think that the biggest success is just the fact that we have been able to prevent war, that we have been able to not only prevent war with 12 and 16 members, which was what we had in the beginning, but now actually 28 members, the enlargement of NATO, where former countries in the Warsaw Pact now have joined NATO. And again, Europe was traditionally the Middle East of the world. We were fighting and fighting each other for centuries. And then since the Second World War, there has been no conflict, at least directly involving NATO countries or an attack against a NATO country. Then respond to Syria. Syria is a very difficult, very dangerous, and very complex situation which affects NATO very much, because Syria is bordering NATO. Syria is bordering Turkey, which is a NATO ally. We participate and support the fight against ISIL. NATO is not on the ground in Syria, but we provide AWACS surveillance planes. We help them with the air picture. But when it comes to the use of chemical weapons, that's totally unacceptable. It's horrendous, and it's violating international law. And those who are responsible must be held accountable for any use of chemical weapons. Therefore, the airstrikes against the Syrian airbase some days ago was a U.S. Operation, military operation, based on U.S. intelligence, but it has received great understanding among NATO allies. Because they understand that it has to have a consequence when someone is using chemical weapons.
And what's next for NATO in Syria?
There has been no call for any NATO presence on the ground in Syria. Some NATO allies are present there. The United States are present there with special operation forces. UK and some other allies help train forces to fight ISIL. And Turkey is also present in the northern part of Syria. But I think that just underlines the complexity of the situation in Syria. And there has been no call for NATO as an alliance to get involved directly in the conflict in Syria.
Very good. More questions. We have, we're going to take this side of the room, and then next time we'll do that side of the room. So over here in the third row in the middle with the glasses and the tie.
Good afternoon, Mr. Secretary General. My question is reflecting on your opening speech. So in the recent years, we've seen the changes in the global security. The cyber attack, the lone wolf terrorism attack are some new challenges to the global security. So my question is, how will NATO adjust itself to facing the new challenges in global security? And how will NATO, working with its members, to fight against the unconventional warfare that a lot of the countries has facing recently? Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. We're going to go to the front row, right here on the corner.
I'm a student here at Elliott School. I want to ask, what's the NATO role now in Libya after they destabilized the country and now it's basically stateless? Like, they have any part of the, like there are many militias fighting. They have, like, supporting a certain militia, like, to take control of the country, or is just, like, forgotten now?
Yeah, okay. And do we have one further back? Let's go back on the left-hand side here. There's a woman with her hand up. Stand up. There you go. Yes. And wait for the microphone. Sorry, I'm making this easy for the mic runners.
Hi, thank you for coming. My question is, how do you ensure that countries in NATO fund within ratio, basically?
Sorry, fund?
How do you ensure that countries fund NATO in ratio? Yeah. So one country isn't paying more than others, that is unfair to
it. I see. So countries paying according to their proportional size,
yes,
or wealth.
Yes,
okay.
Thank you.
Great. So proportionality, Libya cleaning up our mess, and cyber. Well, modern threats and challenges, broader.
First on, cyber, hybrid, all these new threats. I think that one thing we have to understand is that before, it was easy to distinguish whether it was peace or war. And actually, nations declared war, and it was possible to say that now it's war, and now it's peace. And the war was taking place in a well-defined geographical area, and it was very clear when the war ended. And that was, but now there's a much more blurred line between peace and war. And it's much harder to say exactly when did the war against ISIL start and when will it end and where does it take place. Of course, it takes place in Syria and Iraq, but it takes place also in the streets of NATO allied capitals where ISIL is responsible for terrorist attacks against innocent civilians. And it takes place in cyberspace. And I guess it's much harder to say. We don't have exact date for when it started, and I'm afraid we don't have an exact date for when it will end. So the new threats, they are characterized partly by the fact that it's a mixture of civilian and military means of aggression and a much more blurred line between peace and war. NATO is adapting to that too. The higher readiness of our forces, more intelligence, more surveillance, more ability to early warning, all of that is aimed at being able to respond to more hybrid threats, which is a phrase we use for that kind of threats. And also the fact that we are really stepping up when it comes to cyber defenses. We have declared that that cyber defense and cyber attacks can trigger Article 5. Meaning that we regard cyber attacks as serious or as potentially as serious as a kinetic attack. And therefore, if we have a serious cyber attack, we can trigger the Article 5, the Collective Defense Clause of the Alliance. And we are in the process of establishing cyber as a military domain. We have air, sea, land, but now we also have cyber as a military domain. And we have done a lot of other things, for instance, helping allies. Estonia is playing a key role again in sharing best practices, improving their cyber defenses. So, again, NATO can do more, of course, and we are constantly looking for much more we can do, but NATO is adapting to these kind of new threats. Sorry. Then Libya. I think it's important to... Sorry. Libya was not a stable country when NATO went into Libya. There was a civil war going on. and we implemented the UN mandate, and we helped to stop the killing of civilians, which the Gaddafi regime was responsible for. I think if there's anything we can learn from the Libya operation is that one thing is to implement the military operation as we did, but it's extremely important to stabilize the country afterwards. NATO didn't have a mandate, but of course the whole international community, including NATO, the UN, the EU, all of us, have a responsibility for not being more present afterwards. And for me, that underscores the message about that prevention is better than intervention, and also the importance of training local forces, enabling them to stabilize their own country. So we are now, we are in dialogue with the Libyan government, or the government of national accord, and Prime Minister Al-Sarraj, on how NATO can provide support to build defense institutions to help them stabilize their own country. It's not the easy situation, but at least I think that's the best thing to do, is to try to work with the UN-recognized government and help them to stabilize their own country. Then burden sharing or defense spending. In one way, it is a very simple rule or guideline, and that is that every NATO ally should spend or invest in defense 2% of GDP. And GDP reflects, in a way, the income or the wealth of the nation. So rich countries spend more than not-so-rich countries. And as long as they spend 2%, there is a kind of fair burden sharing. The problem is that many allies spend much less than 2% of GDP. And therefore, a way to obtain more fair or balanced burden sharing is to make sure that all spend 2% or perhaps even more. And that's exactly what I have been focusing on. That's exactly what has been the main message from President Trump. But that's a very bipartisan message from the United States, that Canada and those European allies that spend less than 2% have to increase defense spending. And we have started, we have a long way to go, but we have started to move in the right direction.
Great. And we'll take from this side of the room now some students here, second row right here, the young woman in the gray sweater.
The Arctic is seeing the largest military buildup since the 1950s. How is the alliance interpreting Russia's actions in the high north?
Where is the military buildup again? You said Russia?
Yeah, it's Russia.
Yeah, Russia's military buildup, the largest. Okay, back further, the gentleman with the beard.
Thank you, Your Excellency. So following the coup in Turkey, various staff on NATO who were part of the Turkish military were targeted by President Erdogan's political purges. So how has this affected NATO's day-to-day operations, and how does NATO plan to respond to future political upheavals or even human rights abuses in its member states?
Great. Thank you. And we'll go in front of you, the woman there with her hand up. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Secretary General. Earlier in your earlier remarks, you mentioned that NATO's greatest strength is that it is able to deter with credibility. And given the actions of Russia in Crimea in 2014, which you referred to earlier, how will NATO reassert their credibility in Europe, and in what ways should the United States also take action to reassert their credibility within the NATO organization? Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you very much. Over to you, Secretary General. Russia's military buildup, restoring credibility, and the situation of military officers assigned to NATO billets being called home after the coup.
So first, on the Russian military buildup, we have seen a significant military buildup in Russia over many years, as you said. Since 2000, they have approximately tripled defense spending in real terms. But not only spending more, but also, you know, they have developed new and more modern equipment. They are exercising more, and they have a more aggressive pattern of exercises. They also exercise both the nuclear forces and the conventional forces. They have a more rhetoric, which is aiming at intimidating neighbors. And most importantly, they have been willing to use force. Use force against Georgia in 2008, against Ukraine in 2014, and they continue to use military personnel to support and help to support and destabilize eastern Ukraine. And add to that that they also are active in cyber hybrid threats and actions against NATO allied countries. So again, this is the reason why NATO has adapted. This is the reason why we, after many years of reducing defense spending, have started to increase defense spending, and the reason why we have started to deploy forces to the eastern part of the alliance. Having said that, it is extremely important that we don't overdo it or overreact, because if we end up with a new arms race, a new Cold War, we are risking just to increase tensions even further, and not increase our security, but decrease our security. So that's the reason why NATO has been focused on that what we do is proportionate and defensive, and keeping or continuing to work for a political dialogue with Russia. Then Turkey. It's correct that they recalled staff from the NATO command structure after a failed coup attempt. This has, in a very limited degree, affected the NATO activities and operations because they have replaced them. So there are new officers there now from Turkey. I have underlined very much that, of course, Turkey has the right to protect itself. They have suffered terrorist attacks, and there was a failed coup attempt where actually the plotters bombed the National Assembly. I was in the National Assembly in Ankara, and it was very strong impressions to see the National Assembly and the damaged building, and the parliament was bombed when parliamentarians were inside the building. So this was really serious, and hundreds of people were killed. And of course, those behind this failed coup attempt, they should be held responsible. The important thing is that this is done in accordance with the rule of law. And this is something I have raised in Ankara several times, because of course the rule of law is important when you have these kind of processes after a failed coup attempt. Then deterrence. Russia used military force against Ukraine, but it is important not to mix that with NATO deterrence, because NATO deterrence is about deterring any adversary from attacking a NATO allied country. And we have been extremely successful in doing that, because there have been no attack against any NATO allied country since NATO was established. Ukraine is not a NATO member, so it's not a failure of, in a way, NATO deterrence that Russia used military power or force against Ukraine. But we, of course, condemn that use of military force against Ukraine, regardless of whether Ukraine is a NATO member or not, because it's violating international law, it's violating the sovereignty and the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and we support Ukraine. But our deterrence is credible, and we have made sure that it continues to be credible by deploying forces, especially to the eastern part of the line.
We're going to start to wrap up a little bit. I'd like to engage in a dialogue about a couple of things here. One of them, I'm not as forgetful, perhaps, as the Secretary General, because I do think of some NATO mistakes. But one, I think, that is current in modern times, I think NATO was a little slow to recognize that Russia had changed. It wasn't the Russia of the 90s we were dealing with anymore. We were seeing a military buildup. We were seeing aggressive behavior, the invasion of Georgia, the pressure on Georgia before that. And NATO was still playing by the old book. And I think NATO has adapted. I think this the decisions of the Wales Summit, the European Reassurance Initiative from the United States, the positioning of forces in the Baltic States, I think this has compensated for that tremendously. But I think we were slow. And maybe that's the way democracies behave. Maybe democracies naturally don't want to go there unless they absolutely have to. But on the other side of that, I think the greatest thing that NATO has done, at least in the last 25 years, keeping the peace is obviously the obvious one. But the other thing that NATO has done was to inspire countries to reform, to become democracies, market economies, establish the rule of law, protect human rights, and to then allow them to join with other countries to share that common security in a wider area. This is often referred to as NATO enlargement. But I think that even that terminology gets it wrong, because what it really is about widening a space of prosperity and democracy and security in Europe. And we have here today the ambassador of Montenegro, which will be NATO's next ally. The document signed 2 days ago, I believe, here by President Trump. And then we also have the ambassador of Georgia is here. Ambassador of Estonia is here, joined NATO in the Prague enlargement round. And if that is the, first off, I wonder if you agree, is that the one of the great achievements of NATO? And if it is one of the great achievements of NATO, where do we go from here on this process of inspiring that kind of reform and seeing more countries become part of that democratic and secure community?
I absolutely agree with you. I think that so I mentioned preserving the peace, but of course the fact that so many more countries are now part of a family of democratic nations, being member of NATO and or the European Union, has really helped to promote stability, peace, prosperity in Europe. And NATO enlargement is very much part of that. So I agree. Second, NATO is continuing to expand, meaning that we will soon have Montenegro as our 29th member. The United States have now finished the ratification process, so it only remains to have the accession protocol so completed the ratification in the Netherlands and Spain, I think it is. And then we hope to see Montenegro as a full member in June, already within not so many weeks. Then we are working with Georgia. Georgia is, as you said, implementing impressive reforms, strengthening their democratic institutions, modernizing their defense institutions, structures, and fighting corruption. And all of this is partly, at least, because of that, the aspiration to join NATO. I always underline that, of course, to implement that kind of reforms is good because you move closer to NATO. But even if their aim is not to move closer to NATO, you should be able to fight corruption and to strengthen democratic institutions. But there's kind of double reason to do it in a country like Georgia, which is aiming for a NATO membership. And we support them, NATO support them, with this reform process. So NATO's door is open, and we will continue to stress the message that the enlargement, or whether NATO is going to have more members, it's up to the applicant country to decide, and the 28, or then soon to be 29 members. No one else have the right to intervene or to say that they don't accept that a new country become a NATO member.
Very good. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid that's all we're going to have time for today. Please join me in thanking Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg.